From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was supposed to be made next week, Earth Day. Now, the pandemic has not canceled Earth Day. Turns out, you can throw just about anything you want at this planet, and it will still be here. The question is whether we will still be here. In an effort to adapt to the pandemic, the Rochester Regional Group of the Sierra Club has postponed its Earth Day Environmental Forum, but its members are pushing forward with their work. And this hour, we're taking advantage of that. We're talking about how climate change impacts some of us harder than others. Why is that? What might change that? Later this year, they'll hold a forum to bring these issues to the public. And this hour, we're joined by some of the forum's presenters. And it's going to be a fast-moving hour. Got a lot of people to talk to, and I will want to welcome some of the guests now. With us on the line, Peter Debs is the vice chair of the Rochester Regional Group of the Sierra Club. Peter, welcome back to the program. How are you?
Very good. Thank you, Evan. It's good to be here.
Well, it's good to have you. Kim Smith is with us, a community organizer, and she is a candidate for the New York State Senate. Kim, welcome. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
Ron Garrow is an Akwesasne Mohawk, member of the Bear Clan, and a cultural advisor for Surge Rock. Ron, welcome back to the program. How are you?
Doing well, Evan. Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. And Dorian Hall is leader of the Plex Neighborhood Association. Dorian, welcome. How are you?
I am good, good, and thanks for having me.
Well, Peter, you've pulled together a lot of people, and they're going to be bringing their thoughts as we go throughout the hour on a wide range of issues. Why don't you kind of give me the overview about not only what you're going to hope to accomplish later this year with the forum, but what you hope these kind of ideas stitch together and tell us about our world, ourselves.
Okay, and thanks. That's a great way of phrasing it, Evan. And because we may have, in the way we're reaching out this year, some listeners who may not be that familiar with the Sierra Club, I would like to start by giving listeners a quick review of the Sierra Club, how it began. And that way, they can have a better appreciation for what we're initiating in this year's forum. And also that the COVID-19 pandemic has not only postponed this event, but it's helping us understand more deeply this disparate impact of crises on people of color and low-income communities in our area. So the Sierra Club was begun way back in 1892 by a man named John Muir, and some of our listeners, I'm sure, are going to have heard of him. He wanted to preserve and protect beautiful places in the United States for the enjoyment of people, and especially for future generations. So the Sierra Club then has helped a lot in the establishment of a number of national parks, and also programs to get people outdoors to explore those places. It is the largest environmental organization in the United States with over 2 million members. And because of that size, it's divided into regions called chapters, and then each chapter is divided into smaller groups. And the Rochester Regional Group of the Sierra Club is the group that represents our area. So not everybody may know that the Sierra Club was founded as an exclusively white organization and remained predominantly white for most of its history. More recently, however, it has acknowledged this history and has set goals of becoming a more diverse organization. The Rochester Regional Group has a predominantly white membership with close to 3,000 members. For many years, our group has been focused on things like protecting natural areas, especially like the purchase by the state of Canada's hemlock lands, promoting establishments of parks and encouraging people to get outdoors. For more than 20 years, we have organized a major event each year on Earth Day, which we call our Environmental Forum. And we've used this event to help raise awareness of some environmental issues in our community. Then came research evidence of how human activity is causing climate change. And the National Sierra Club realized this problem superseded all others in terms of the future of our planet. At this point, the Rochester Regional Group began focusing on raising awareness of climate change and its impacts here in Rochester. And then a lot of people will remember the People's Climate March in 2014 in New York City, a very large activist event organized by the People's Climate Movement. And that was specifically to advocate Global Action for Climate Change. The Sierra Club did play a major role in the staging of that march, and it's interesting that a key feature of that that caught my attention was that there was a special section for representatives of groups most at risk for the damaging effects of climate change. They were at the head of the march. And this included especially people who were living in places that were already being flooded by rising oceans. So this climate change march was pretty pivotal for the Rochester Sierra Club in striving to make real change and become more diverse ourselves in partnership with other climate organizations. And we decided to learn how to address the impacts of climate change on our whole community, especially people of color and low-income families. So as this 2020 environmental forum planning progressed, we began making connections to leaders locally here of historically excluded communities so that we would have a diverse planning team. And these leaders have been instrumental in helping us rethink the way we do things and how do we develop a forum and help us refine a very clear mission. So the mission for this year's forum is climate change worsens all injustices. It directly impacts the health, environment, and economics of our communities. Throughout 2020, we are committed to establishing an inclusive and comprehensive movement that educates, responds, and benefits all.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead, Peter.
Yeah. As we're seeing now, so heartbreakingly, the COVID-19 pandemic is informing us of how coming climate change crises will continue to worsen the injustices to communities that are already at risk because of structural racism and classism. And the speakers from our planning team will address some of these intersections of injustices, which will include environmental, COVID, and climate change.
All right. So why don't we turn to them now? And I want to bring in Kim Smith first, who is a why don't you tell us, before we kind of talk about your area of focus, Kim, tell us a little bit about the work you've done as a community organizer.
So as a community organizer, I'm actually a statewide organizer, organizing in three cities, Rochester, Buffalo, and Syracuse. And we organize to end homelessness, HIV, mass incarceration, and the opioid epidemic. And I am building chapters in each of those cities to create more equitable policies and just to create some systemic change.
Now, when we look at the impact on communities across the country, not just of climate change, but there's been a lot of discussion about COVID-19 and where we do have data, which is not everywhere, but the more cities and places we're starting to see data, we do see a disproportionate share of the pain of the tragedy borne out in communities of color. Why don't you kind of take us through what you're going to be presenting for the Rochester Regional Group of the Sierra Club in this forum, Kim?
So what I can tell you is, first, I am not a climate expert. For example, based on my personal background and experiences growing up in the city of Rochester, my connection to climate change has been through environmental justice. And knowing the impact the environment has had on the health of people of color communities, such as respiratory illnesses, elevated lead levels, asthma, all of this making us more susceptible to other life-threatening illnesses and diseases such as COVID-19. And I want more for our environment and for our health. So not only do I want better access to healthcare and resources, but a deeper understanding of the extra layer and role climate change has played in the health of our communities.
Kim, as we started to get more information on how this pandemic was impacting communities, it in some ways calls to mind the way we understand how climate change is impacting vulnerable communities around the world. Were you surprised at all, Kim, to see that infection rates for COVID-19 were higher in communities of color, that death rates were higher, that intubation rates were higher? Did that surprise you at all?
Not at all, especially when you look at the injustices and inequities surrounding health outcomes. And there has always been countless research about the direct link between poverty and infectious disease. So coming in with all of that information, it was certainly no surprise what we're seeing in low-income communities and communities of color around COVID.
What are the steps you'd like to see taken to reduce the disparities in health care options?
Well, one thing that I do know, so we know that we have the ACT poverty report that comes out that talks about poverty, low-income communities, but that's all information gathering. But when you look specifically at the people of color community, you want to look at that Common Ground Health report that really speaks to what is happening in low-income and African-American communities, and it also offers solutions that include outreach education. And when we talk about outreach, we are talking about very client-centered approaches where you meet people where they are, provide them resources and education, which leads to better problem solving and better outcomes.
Do you see anything about the way the public discourse is moving during this pandemic that leads you to believe we're going to have a serious conversation in states and nationally about how we address health care?
Not if we don't get our leaders to listen. So right now, currently, we continue to hear messages about disobedience to social distancing with very little regard to why that is happening. It is not blatant disobedience. It is survival. It is communities trying to go out, get adequate housing, adequate food, and the lack of resources prevent them from doing that. And so we're talking about a population where staying home is sometimes not an option. So if you really want to promote social distancing for low-income communities, what really needs to happen is emergency responses that are geared towards providing them with adequate resources to do just that, to be obedient to the social distancing so that we can have better health outcomes.
And sometimes it sounds like housing has got to be a part of that combination.
Housing is a huge part of that combination. And if you've been following anything on the Rochester Citywide Tenant Union, they have really been active about putting in the work, bringing together organizations such as the organization that I work for, Vocal New York, and really pushing to find not only adequate housing and housing for people, especially the homeless, during this time of COVID, but using this as an opportunity to house the homeless permanently.
Kim, I was reading some of the work from a writer who has tried to chronicle some of the most, in his words, forgotten communities in the country. And he recently was very frustrated that this conversation about COVID infection rates and healthcare disparities, you know, once we started to see Milwaukee, Chicago, some other places publish their data, then there was pressure on other cities and other states to publish their data to get a real look at this. There were some who kind of bristle at social justice movements, and they were saying, how could you even make COVID a social justice movement? Come on, this is just a disease. And this writer, who happens to be a white man, who wrote a book called Dignity, he said, this is not just social justice activism for the sake of it. This is actually looking at how we have forced poverty onto communities and then what happens and who's going to be infected most often when there's a pandemic. When people are vulnerable, guess where the disease has a chance to move more quickly? In denser communities, in communities where there aren't housing options, in communities where there aren't healthcare options. And he was quite angry about it. What would you say to people who think, well, why do you have to bring race into a pandemic? What would your message be, Kim?
It would go back to the research studies, and that is there is a direct correlation between poverty, low-income communities, and poor health outcomes. When people do not have, when people are at a socioeconomic disadvantage, when people suffer discrimination, when there is job and housing instability, where there is food insecurity, all of that puts stress on the body, and that type of stress on the body decreases the immune system, making us more vulnerable and susceptible to those diseases.
Peter Debs, before I turn to the other guests, you want to weigh in on these points that Kim is making, what you hope the community will learn?
Oh, I mean, I'm totally supportive of all that. I mean, I experienced a lot of learning about that when I was a teacher at Wilson Magnet High School, working with students, predominantly students of color there. So I just definitely affirm everything she said on that.
I want to turn to Ron Garrow, who is going to be talking about what vision and really what understanding Indigenous people can bring to the plight of environmental injustice, the kind that we've been talking about, and what we can do to restore our own health and the health of the planet, which has been a theme in Indigenous communities forever. Ron, go ahead.
Hi. How you doing, Evan? Hey, Kim. Well, what we see going on right now is just further evidence of some negative consequences that the Indigenous people have been receiving since colonization has begun. We really have to change our viewpoint on environmental awareness. We have to be aware of our actions and what we do and be appreciative of nature, and it's pretty much that simple.
Ron, I'm sorry, go ahead. Keep going.
Oh, no, I was just saying, and the effects are just like Kim was saying. I mean, we're had health effects that are affecting low-income communities, such as reservations.
And Ron, when we look around the world and we see the social distancing that has led to most people not getting on the road, we don't really see air traffic, car traffic. Obviously, for the moment, we're seeing emissions down. We're seeing clearer skies. I wasn't fully on board with a comment that someone made on social media that went viral that said, well, this just proves that human beings are the disease and the coronavirus is the vaccine for the planet, which is, that is an extreme view. I don't view human beings as a disease on the planet. I view us as beings who have a choice. We have a choice on how we want to interact with the natural environment. We have agency over how we build our lives and structure our societies. But I think there's certainly lessons we can learn when we see the skies clearing and when we see, the waters clearing. What are the lessons do you think we ought to be drawing right now in this sort of pause moment that we're in?
Well, it appears like Mother Earth has spoken and said, if you guys won't clean up this mess, I will. Everybody go to your rooms. That is pretty much what I'm seeing happening here. And as we all are self-distancing and staying in our homes and we have less carbon emissions, as you said, the world is cleaning itself up. These are facts that we can't dispute. So hopefully the data is showing that the value system of the people that are in charge of the policy that is being made needs to be changed to reflect better environmentalism and appreciation of this planet that we live on.
Are you confident that we'll make those changes, Ron?
Well, the data is proving it. I mean, we've been telling Indigenous people have been talking about this since first contact, and we haven't been listened to. And now we have scientific proof to something that we've known all along. So I'm thinking that these changes can be made. And this is the focus of the forum that we're going to be having, and hopefully with cultural exchanges. And, we got 2 million people in the Sierra Club that I'm a part of. Hopefully with these cultural exchanges, we can begin to send waves out into the community and make some positive environmental changes. And we don't need, we need more awareness and the Indigenous viewpoint is more, we have to leave the planet
a better place for our, not just our grandchildren, but our grandchildren's grandchildren. And that's our motivation and how we need to view the environment.
Peter Debs, do you feel like we've all been sent to our rooms?
I think that may make us smile, but it's a very apt way of looking at it, and also noting the consequences that the clearing up of the atmosphere and also toxic fumes in the cities and smells of the highway and so on. So and Ron also had brought to us a wonderful proverb of the indigenous people that points to this. Could you say that one, Ron?
Which one were we referring to? We have not inherited this planet from our ancestors. We are borrowing it from our children.
Excellent.
And when you live in this thought process and you live the thought of we need to leave this planet a better place for our grandchildren's grandchildren, that's when change will be made.
Yeah, I think, Ron, I think that's beautifully said. The question now is, what do we do with these lessons? Peter, are you an optimist that we're going to take these lessons forward with us?
I guess I'm an optimist who, at the worst level, says we'll be forced to in ways that are very unpleasant if we don't.
Well, I'd like to say I'm an optimist. I think we certainly are capable of learning lessons. And I think one of the reasons I am is because we have made massive changes, and we did it in just a couple of weeks' time. And a lot of people are suffering. People are out of work. They're scared for their futures, but they're also making these changes as a form of collective sacrifice to protect the most vulnerable among us. So yeah, I think what we're learning is we can do it. We definitely can do it. And now it's up to us on what we want to carry past the pandemic and into our collective future. And someone who's been working for a long time on issues that impact individual neighborhoods, individual communities, and especially when there's inequities, is Dorian Hall, who's the PLEX Neighborhood Association. Dorian, remind listeners where PLEX is.
So PLEX is called the Plymouth Exchange Neighborhood Association, and it is on the west side of the Genesee River. So I tell people the U of R is our sister. And if you were to go down to the Rochester Wall Memorial, we are that neighborhood, Plymouth Avenue. I call it the heart of the city. And you drive down that vein to downtown Rochester.
Very good. Well, the floor is yours. I mean, I know you've got a lot to say about how industrialization and more has impacted communities of color, especially PLEX. Go ahead.
Okay. So, one of the things that was shocking to me is we had the conversation about climate control. And one of the things that was important is we were introduced to the brownfield because of a development. So I grew up not knowing at all that I live by a brownfield, which is pretty much contaminated land. And climate change plays a role because those VOCs or that contaminated soil, if you have heavy rains, that stuff could rise. If you have a very hot summer, those VOCs could also rise. And you just want to make sure that those things do not affect the health of the community. And predominantly, most African Americans are being affected by, as you can see, the COVID-19. And in my neighborhood, this brownfield, which I grew up not knowing it was a brownfield, but enjoying the land. And I wanted to make sure that, you know, people could see a great example right here in Rochester, that brownfield where people walk the trail and they run the trail and they jog, but you don't see a fence around those properties that are contaminated. And some of the examples that I give of environmental injustice is if you go through Rochester and you go on Main Street, you'll see a brownfield site and there's a fence around it. You go down downtown, the old RG&E space, you see the building is tore down, there's a fence around it. You go to the old bus station, you'll see there's a fence around that. But if you go on the trail, you'll see there's no fence around those contaminated sites in the PLEX Neighborhood Association. So it's kind of giving you an example of environmental injustice. And then if they don't clean that site up correct, you know, climate change risks that the neighborhood and people currently living there and future people who move in there and enjoy the neighborhood are at risk because of those VOCs. So that's kind of my little point I wanted to add.
What do you think this moment affords us when it comes to making changes, Dorian?
So I think that there needs to be some new policies in place, but I don't see it happening because everything is driven by money. And we need to start focusing on people's lives over money. I wish that was a hashtag, but, you know, maybe we can start that, lives over money. Because what I witnessed around development and even with this COVID-19 is the people who are most affected are obviously people of color, people of low income, but people generally who have major dollars don't care, right? They're like, let's get everyone back to work. You know, we can lose a few lives. Let's get everyone back to work. And you know, the people who we lose, you know, they took it for the country. So that's kind of, so I see that we need to change policies that protect people. Is what I'm.
Just let me build on that point, because I think this is so important. We are going to continue to have a series of conversations right here on this program about what it means to reopen the country. We're probably, as the governor said, and as Ed Yong in the Atlantic writes this week, I think absolutely aptly, we're not going to go back to the way it was on March 1st anytime soon. I mean, even if we quote-unquote reopen, we're not snapping back to that world when there's a virus with no vaccine, when there's concern about infection and death. But we will probably, given the economic pain people are feeling, we'll probably see efforts made to maybe slowly and step-by-step reopen. The question that I have, and I think that Dorian is raising here, and Dorian, maybe you can kind of expand on this point, is if, let's say tomorrow, the president or the governor said, okay, we're reopened, everything's back open, whatever you want to do, most people would not go out to eat in crowded spaces. Most people would not go to a movie theater. They wouldn't go to a game. They wouldn't go do things in crowded spaces because they're aware that there's a risk. And my guess is the wealthier people in this country who want to see the, quote, economy back open, who are worried about their 401ks, are probably not going to be out there mixing with other people, but they want work. They want the working class to do it. They want the working class to go back to work for them. And so there is a disproportionate burden of risk in a reopening in this kind of way, and we've got to be very careful and serious about what that means. And I'm curious to know if you want to add to that, Dorian.
Yeah, and I'll add to that. And you kind of, this is a great example, because the people who are the frontline workers are the people at grocery stores, are the people who really are low-income people, right? And your bosses are probably at home, remoted in working, and, you know, or they're probably, you know, somewhere in their penthouse relaxing and you know, but the everyday people who have to work, and I tell people about climate change, it's harder for African-Americans because most African-Americans are looking to survive and pay those bills and make that paycheck. Not saying that others are not, but, you know, the importance of, you know, paying rent, which is a big deal right now. Will they freeze rent? Will they not freeze rent? So now you have people under stress, worried about, you know, will they be able to make it through next month? Can they pay their bills? So, yeah, that's kind of the big problem. And I do see it being hard because I look at the entertainment business. That sector is going to be hit really hard because, you know, you're going to start seeing virtual concerts and things are changing. And how do you, I was just talking to someone about dating. You know, I'm a single guy. How do you find that next loved one? Am I going to be now a professional dater on these sites because the social stuff is changing? So anyway, but you're correct.
Yeah, there's a lot that goes into reopening society. And when they say, when a governor or the president says, I want to see people back in movie theaters, they ought to go to the movies then. You know, and I don't think they're going to. And I'm not saying I want anyone to get sick, but I'm saying they want other people to do it for their benefit. at a time of great risk. And there's a real moral question to that. So, Dorian, Ron, Kim, really interesting stuff. I want to thank all three of you for weighing in with your thoughts and what you're going to be bringing to the Sierra Club when we can sort of, again, re-engage with more in-person forums. But thanks for taking the time. And Peter, you want to jump in?
Yeah. Evan, I got one thing.
Oh, Ron, go ahead.
When you said we're, you know, going back to how it was, I mean, first, that's the issue. We can't go back to the way it was because the way it was the problem to begin with. Mm-hmm. We need to have environmental awareness, and change has to happen. That's how we're going to get better.
We've got an opportunity now. We certainly do. We've learned that we can do it. So great point. Thank you, Ron, Kim, Dorian.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank
After
you.
Our only break of the hour, we're going to bring in more guests who are working with the Sierra Club. So let's get that break and come right back on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections, a conversation with Assemblyman Harry Bronson and some of his colleagues as we take a look at the state budget and figure out just how it's going to impact our community, what's fair during a crisis, what might change. In our second hour, we close the week with a look at the arts community. Some very creative people are finding creative ways to stay engaged during the pandemic. We'll bring you their art. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I'm going to ask Peter Debs to remind our listeners why we're here. He's the vice chair of the Rochester. Oh, we've lost Peter. Oh, so I'm not going to ask Peter to do that. I'm going to ask Terry Chaka to kind of jump in here with us. Terry's the executive director of the Baobab Center and also contributing to the conversation that the Rochester Regional Group of the Sierra Club has put together. Hi, Terry. How are you?
Hi, Evan. How are you? I'm doing well.
Terry, there's a lot of moving parts this hour. First of all,
yes.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about what you do at the Baobab Center?
Well, I'm not the executive director now. I have gone to the board of directors, and we are an organization that talks about and educates the community about the African diaspora. So wherever people of African descent live and are from, whether it be in America or in the Caribbean or, you know, in continental Africa or in Europe. So that's what we celebrate, are the contributions of people of African descent.
Well, as we look at what's happening around the world right now, and environmental mm-hmm. injustice is not new. And I want to talk about a little bit about how you see that manifesting in the city, especially in parts of the city where there may be unequal access to things like food, nutrition. How do you see it?
Well, first of all, many non-whites, and particularly, and I think it was said earlier, that are concentrated in urban areas where there's lack of green space and more polluted air, you know, they see climate change as not being so significant next to, you know, their other outstanding issues of poverty and health disparities. Not understanding, of course, that that the food supply affects those things. So, you know, climate change definitely would affect the food supply. And that has to do with health, of course. So, but environmental organizations, they tend not to trust or listen to, because these organizations are may be culturally insensitive. And this is according to a report by Dr. Dorsetta Taylor, who is an environmental specialist, that, you know, they feel that these organizations are culturally insensitive, and they're very reluctant if people of color were to become involved, to promote them to leadership positions or to even recruit them. So there's a lack of trust there. And therefore, sometimes we tend to look at things as being a white issue and not our issue at all.
So what is this period of time where everything has sort of changed in our country? What could this do if we're going to actually see change happening? Do you see an opportunity here?
Well, there's an opportunity for a lot of things, because first of all, a lot of people have to be still. And so when you're still, not only are you listening to other people, but you're listening to yourself. So there is an opportunity here. And I have to go to the educational piece, of course, because that's what I've been doing. And misinformation comes about because people lack the exact knowledge and the facts that they need in order to understand what the situation is. So I know I was talking about Dr. Dorsetta Taylor before, and she's a Black woman from Jamaica, environmental psychologist with degrees in forestry and sociology from Yale. And she's written several books. The last couple, The Rise of the American Conservation Movement, Power, Privilege, and Environment Protection. And another one, which is Toxic Communities, Environmental Racism, Industrial Pollution, and Residential Mobility. So that kind of says a mouthful. But I think it means more when people understand or people can see that there is someone like them that has done a study, they are more likely to listen. So that's the educational piece that, you know, I at least wanted to mention here.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find yourself more or less optimistic these days?
I tend to be cautiously optimistic most of the time. So I heard what Peter said earlier. So, but yeah, I look at this as a time when we're forced to look at things, that's when we a lot of times see them, because when we're in a hurry, we're rushing around and, you know, trying to do this and do that. A lot of things that are really pretty obvious are going past us. So, but, you know, what you were saying about food, I'm looking at that as being what I call, or what some people might call, culinary injustice. So ironically, as people of African descent, or I might say non-whites, because, you know, I want to include the Latino community, even though some of them may not identify as such, but DNA will tell you a little differently. We were the people that brought sustainable farming and composting and all of those kinds of things to this country, basically because we were doing all of the work, particularly in the South. So this idea, this notion that we don't know what foods are good for us when we were the ones that actually cultivate those good foods, yes, we've kind of unlearned what foods are good for us because of the foods that are available or not available to us. So, you know, you just look around the community, the disparities of access to healthy foods, the number of grocery stores versus and farmers markets versus liquor stores and gas stations, you know, and corner stores, which there are plenty of. But I remember when there used to be grocery stores on the west side. There was, I think it was Star Market. You know, some people can think that far back, you know. There was a Bell's. Tops is the only one now. I remember when Wegmans moved out, you know, and a lot of these supermarkets are only on either the edge of the city where they're going into suburban communities, but they're not non-existent. Now, two positive things that are happening in our area, particularly on Genesee Street, is there is a food place, but it's not a grocery store, but it's a place where you can get food, and it's called B Plus Healthy, which offers very healthy alternatives to what's normally in the community, so very healthy eating. This is probably their third year of being open, mm-hmm. and they're always crowded. So that lets you know that people want to eat healthier. And the other thing is that during the summer, there's the farmer's market in the St. Monica's parking lot on Tuesdays. That's only one day, and it's for a couple of hours. So, you know, just bringing this awareness because, you know, it is a political issue. It is a social justice and racial justice issue, even though some people may not want to look at it that way.
That's Terry Chaka from the Baobab Center. And let me bring in Pastor Jonathan McReynolds from Enon Baptist Church, which is going to host the Sierra Club's event when it happens later in the year. Again, it's been a lot of Earth Day celebrations and events have been moved, though Earth Day stays because the Earth stays. So, Pastor McReynolds, let me bring in Pastor McReynolds. How are you, sir?
I'm fine. How are you today?
Well, hang it in there. I know you think there is a moral imperative to address disparities in health and health care, especially during a pandemic, but always. Take me through how you see our moral responsibility when we look at these disparities.
Okay. There are four core issues that we have to recognize and that I try to debate in this whole process to change our paradigm and praxis. First, there is a moral issue regarding environmental justice. We just need to do the right thing regarding our environment. Secondly, there is a theological issue, because I believe, coming from the faith community, that God has made us stewards over the environment and the earth, and that we are to handle it wisely. Thirdly, I think that there is also a racial component, a racial issue, because just as we're finding in the COVID-19 virus epidemic, African Americans, Latinos are greatly impacted by environmental issues, and the same issues that make us more susceptible to health issues, I think, translate over into environmental issues. And just as we're having the current health crisis, eventually we're going to have an environmental crisis. And then the final thing is, I think there is an economic issue, because when we look at how economics and class correlate with environmental justice, we find that environmental injustice crosses many demographic lines. So it doesn't just impact African Americans, it doesn't just impact Latinos, but it also impacts poor white people in the community that are sometimes also voiceless and helpless on many issues in our community.
Do you think that we are doing the right thing or the appropriate things during this crisis to make the kind of changes you think we need? Or do you fear that at the end of this, not much will change when it comes to those disparities, Pastor?
I think that we are hopefully raising awareness to these disparities. And I think people such as myself and others that have platforms in the public square, we have a responsibility to do three things. We have to raise public awareness on these issues. We have to develop public advocacy of where we are doing coalition building, like the Sierra Club is doing now, by reaching out to diverse groups of people to advocate for the common good. And we also have to impact public policy. So my hope and desire is, at the end of the day, when we emerge from the COVID-19 virus, that with these three elements working together, raising awareness, public advocacy, and impacting public policy, that our world would not go back to what it has been prior to this global pandemic. And I think we have to realize that we're all in this together, and we have to work together to make our communities and our world a better place.
One of our listeners, Alex, writes to say that that there's a disconnect when we look at environmental issues and justice issues, and that the Sierra Club remains primarily white upper class. And I want to ask our guests about this. In fact, all four of our guests on the line, because Alex's point is not necessarily incorrect. And as Peter Debs mentioned earlier this hour, as the vice chair of the Rochester Regional Group of the Sierra Club was founded as an exclusively white organization. It has racist roots, and the members, especially in recent years, have worked hard to change that and to not only bring diversity to its ranks and its leadership, but to focus on issues where there are disparities in environmental issues and health issues and how those things intersect. Let me ask all of you, Kim Smith, who I think is still on the line with us, what would you say to Alex saying, you know, hey, the Sierra Club might be a little out of touch here, it's still mostly wealthy or middle or upper class whites, How do you see it, Kim? Do we have... go ahead, Kim.
Can you hear me?
I can. Go ahead.
So I absolutely agree with Alex. And when we sat at the table with the Sierra Club, the first thing that we wanted to do was change the narrative because of their history. And so that was the reason for the creation of the 2020 objective statement and the reason for the forum. So through the Sierra Club's 2020 objective and forum, we now have the opportunity to create a comprehensive and collective climate change movement that brings together people from various community groups. And it is that kind of diversity that allows for the opportunity to create comprehensive and collective messaging, understanding, processes, and solutions.
Okay. Dorian Hall, how would you respond to Alex's email?
So I would respond saying that the Sierra Club was a big, 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 big support to Plex with the Brownfield, and they were the organization to help move the needle for the cleanup, to actually move towards a better cleanup. And the Sierra Club stood on the picket line with us. They helped us organize. We worked together. It was actually shocking because, just from a personal perspective, I've never had anyone, specifically a white male, stand up for me in the community. And it was a shock because we had a meeting and Peter Debs, he spoke out against what was going on. And I can tell you, everyone who was in that meeting, in that room, was shocked because we had never experienced someone speak up for a predominantly African-American community. So I would say that partnering with the Sierra Club actually helped us in the long run. And it, we had their members support and write letters and speak to helping the community make sure that contaminated area was cleaned up. I mean, technically, when you look at the neighborhood, people who actually do the environmental work, they're dressed up in protective gear, and they're walking just like you see with the coronavirus 19, you know, and that says something. To see someone walking your neighborhood in protective gear, I mean, you're not protected, and the only organization standing with you, the Sierra Club, is a blessing.
Mm. Terry and Jonathan, maybe about 30 seconds apiece as we start to run out of time. Go ahead, Terry.
Well, I haven't worked with the Sierra Club, so I don't know what more, you know, I can say. Of course, I've known Peter for some time, so he actually convinced me to kind of, jump on board and see if we could get the word out into the community. Just about what's, about this happening. So,
and Pastor McReynolds?
I would say, in response to Alex's email, that's a history that's shared by most organizations in America.
Mm-hmm.
I could make the same argument about the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, but when we have an opportunity to get involved, to make a difference, and to collaborate, we have to make the most of that opportunity. So I would say we can't look back at the past, but we now have to look at the lessons learned and make positive choices and move into the future together.
I want to thank all of you, Pastor McReynolds, Terry, Dorian, Kim. Thanks for making the time for us for this program, and we'll talk again on a different day where maybe we can see you in person.
Yeah,
okay. Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
So listeners, if you want to check out more about the event that the Sierra Club is going to put together, again, it was aimed to kind of coincide with Earth Day, which is next week, but can't really do in-person forums now. But they're going to try to do a lot to engage with the online and in other places. And if you want to check out their Facebook page to learn more, the Rochester Regional Group of the Sierra Club is there. I also want to mention that today happens to be Public Radio Music Day. We love music on Public Radio. 91.5 WRUR. They do great stuff, and they are such wonderful partners. I know you appreciate them, and you appreciate the mission. And you're going to hear me say this a lot in the coming days, because I'm just going to be blunt and I'm going to be frank, and we should be honest with each other during a crisis. We're all going to be in some hard times. And, frankly, WXXI is going to be in the category of having to make some hard decisions if we don't find a way to keep funding what we're doing, because we're hurting. in a lot of different ways. Today is a day to support WXXI and public radio for music. It's Public Radio Music Day, and there's an easy way to do this. WXXI.org/give. WXXI.org/give. And I'll also be blunt and say, if you're hurting, if you're out of work, I'm not really talking, you know, to people who are hurting. I'm talking to all of us who have been able to keep our jobs, keep working, work from home, feel fortunate when others are hurting. And what do you value in your community? This crisis will be a time for us to identify what we value and work our tails off to keep it. Please support public radio. WXXI.org/give. Thank you for that. Thanks to the whole team today. MRA Stein is the intern. Megan Mack is the producer. Rob Braden is the engineer. I'm Evan Dawson. Hope you have a wonderful afternoon. We'll talk to you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.